This is Kim Mooney with Practically Dying in Boulder, Colorado. I'm working out of KGNU, our local community radio station, and I'm interviewing today Kate Riley, who wrote an incredible book about her mother's death. And, you know, we know that there are lots of different kinds of losses, but losing a mother and going through that process is very unique. So her book is called Launching V's Chariot. V-E-E was her mom's name or nickname, Launching V's Chariot, an end-of-life tale. And I want to, first of all, thank you for getting on the radio with us this morning, Kate.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure.
Can you give us some sense, not only of the relationship between you and your mom, but how it was that V actually pulled you into Embrace Her Death? How did she get you involved and open to this?
Well, after she was diagnosed with 9 malignant tumors.
Wow.
I was sitting on her bed with her, and she looked at me and said, "Kate, will you lean into my dying?"
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, it's a moment I won't ever forget, and I still get a little emotional about it because it was such an intimate moment, and I have to say that I really didn't have any choice. It was something that that I knew that I needed to do. It felt natural. It felt organic, even ancient.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when that started. And so we went 9 months.
Wow, what a precious invitation, for one thing. But even that language, lean into my dying with me, really indicates a very particular kind of help that she wanted and something she wanted to give to you. That's wonderful.
Such a gift.
Yeah.
In the end. Yeah.
Do you have a short excerpt that you could read? Because I'd like listeners to get a flavor for what the book is about and a little bit more about your experience with your mom.
Sure. I have an excerpt from my preface that I am happy to read. For 9 months, I was committed. After all, what does a daughter say to her mother after being asked, "Kate, will you lean into my dying?" Sitting on her bed that day, gazing into my mother's eyes, I captured everything V was made up of, a galaxy of stars and light and beauty, expansion. There was no fear, so I had no reason to generate my own. Love traveled on a golden thread between our hearts, and I knew without a doubt I would devote whatever time it took.
There are some beautiful phrases in just that. That's in the preface of your book, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
To start out a journey like that with no fear and to have none generated for you is incredibly rare and unusual. So the first question I can think of is, what was that journey like, the difference between what you anticipated it would be like and what it was actually like for you? What did you learn in that you didn't expect?
I know that I learned that it's very possible to drop in to a very deep, deep presence of being. I've worked in the field of death and dying for 29 years, but never on a continuing basis for 9 months. And so there were times when there was nothing to be said or nothing to do, but to just be. And so my mother and I dropped into that place, and I have a deep reverence for that. And so that's probably one of the biggest things that I learned, and how important that is to be able to, you know, to do and not to have any agenda, because we never know, doctors or whoever can tell us what they think, you know, the timeline is, and no one knows. I think the soul has its own agenda.
Mm-hmm.
And so the more we can show up without an agenda, I think the freer we are to just be with it all.
Mm-hmm. It also strikes me that when it's your mother, which is a unique relationship, there's an automatic connection, because clearly she midwifed you into the world and you midwifed her out. So there's a deep resonance that doesn't have to be created. But the piece about not feeling fearful, Was that true even from the diagnosis that you both approached it that way, or was that more true along the way, like when she invited you to lean into this with her? When did you realize that you had no fear of this process and all you wanted to do was be present? Was it at the beginning?
No. I have to say it was that day on the bed, and that was after the doctor's visit where we learned about the cancer. You know, I was numb. You know, I had the typical reaction of hearing. We suspected, and I know at least my mother suspected a malignancy, and we didn't know that there would be 9 tumors, but and 7 of them were bone. So it was just this, like, process where I had to, after I dropped her off at her home, I had to go home. I just had to kind of absorb it all. You know, it's just kind of like I had to go into my own buffer zone. And I think that that's what helped me then for that day. But, you know, when someone has absolutely no fear about something like that and is not generating fear, you know, I think I go back to how many people are in fear mode because others being in fear mode. And I've witnessed that in families. So, yeah, I think that that moment, you know, it was really on the bed that day with her 9 months before she died.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And what was it about her or her life that allowed her to approach her death with no fear?
My mother was very present with her life, and she was not a fearful person. So I think that taking responsibility for her life, in turn, it was just an automatic thing for her then to take responsibility and to be accountable for her own death.
Mm-hmm.
She planned well, and that's in the book, and stayed present through it. I mean, there were times, you know, there are definitely times that, you know, I write about that when she had her moments and I had my moments. But my mother's moments were short-lived.
Mm-hmm.
And she stayed with it, you know, to the very end.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what made it so beautiful in the end is I was so proud of her.
Mm-hmm.
I was so proud of her. And I was happy.
That's an interesting and wonderful thing to be able to say. As well as knowing, you know, we know that you die often, most often you die the way you lived. So her ability to be present. And the other skill I hear in there is that it doesn't mean that you never feel fear. It means that when fear comes up, you know how to move with it and let it go.
Right. And she, that's probably another thing that I learned. I was, my moments were short-lived as well. And I don't, I have to say that it, I had more of a frustration at being the primary caregiver than moments of fear. I really didn't have a lot of fear. It was more, you know, teetering on frustration and finding that balance to keep going. And somehow I found it. You know, it's I tapped into this reservoir of strength that I didn't know that was there.
Tell me more about the frustration. What kind of frustrations were you dealing with?
You know, it's ongoing. It's 24/7. So, and 9 months is a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there were times when I'd walk in and she'd say, well, I'm still here. And she was feeling frustration, too, because she hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And she was so ready to leave. And it was just a waiting game. And so even with people bringing us meals every other day and hospice coming in, it's still very... it's a hard thing to show up for, and I applaud anyone out there that's doing that right now. It's I gave up everything, most of my work, and I was there. And I vowed that the day that I took her back home from the doctor's office that I would remain with her.
Mm-hmm.
I lived 3 blocks from her, so it was easy. That piece of it was easy.
It's very powerful, though, when you talk about tapping into a reservoir, because my experience of being a caregiver for very long is that it is exhausting on every single level, even if have help. But the other thing is that sometimes it was boring. You know, my mother was also waiting to die, and we'd watch TV, and it was like, when is this going to be over? And there were moments, I would say most of it felt very sacred, but there were also times where all we did was live a life that we were waiting to have over. It was just a combination of so many different amazing things. It was like we ran the gamut of all of the different pieces of life. So how did you tap into a reservoir? Where did you go? Was it taking care of yourself better physically? Was it something that was, directly related to your mother's strength? What do you mean you tapped into a reservoir? Because I think caregivers need to hear this from other people.
Yeah, well, I think being with her, being present with whatever that moment was, it was really short-lived. And I think my mom had the capacity to move in and through, like you said. So it was when you're with somebody that's doing that, I naturally moved in and out. But there were times when I remember walking out of her house and across her lawn and maybe down the street a bit, holding my head. I remember that with both hands, thinking, God, how much more of this am I going to be able to take? Because, you are impacted on an emotional and psychological level, and you need to really be mindful of that. And I knew I had to be there. There was nobody else that could or would take my place. And so it wasn't, I didn't really have a choice but to show up. So maybe I would go and lie down in the backyard on my back and just stare up at the sky and watch the clouds go over. And then when I stood up and walked back in the house, it was like, I shifted. I also read a book, Befriending Death. I don't remember the author's name. And, that book was my Bible through the 9 months. It helped me. And I think ultimately I was able to befriend my mother's death. And in doing so, I have befriended my own.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm so free and okay when that time comes. And so that was the other thing she gave me. But I also journaled. I'm a writer, but I journaled through a lot of, every day, continuously. And journaling is a way for me to move in and out of whatever I'm feeling. Hmm. I've done that for 25 years, maybe longer, 30 years. And so I know that that's a good way for me to take care of myself.
So what I heard is three things. And by the way, you did have a choice. You may not feel like it, but it is, when I say it's sacred work, you could have hired somebody. There are lots of other choices besides deciding to sacrifice your life and putting your heart in the middle of that and living your whole life for someone. And I applaud you because you made that choice. It was a choice. And I want you to honor that. I want to honor you for that because it is a lot of hard work and other people may not have chosen it. And for other people, it may be good not to have chosen it. But it sounds to me like you followed your life path and allowed your mother to give you a legacy that a lot of people don't have.
Right. So. And tremendous gifts in it. So that's the surprise.
I know. And it takes a while after a death to be able to, go through the whole process to actually see it in its entirety and see the transformational value and how it ends up really being about pure love, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So what I heard in your caregiving pieces is that you did organically three things that are really critical for caregivers. You got back in your body, you took a relief and got back in your own body, and you sought good information when you're talking about reading Befriending Death. So that you weren't isolated in it. But the deepest piece is this journaling, that you knew already what was going to nourish you and how to self-reflect back to you, to yourself, around what was going on. Was this when you started the book? Was this journaling actually the start of your book?
No, I took it. She died in September, and so it wasn't until December or January that I started really sitting down to write the book. And so what I did at that point was I was mining my journal, going through it and pulling out key paragraphs or one-liners, and I was also mining my mother's journals. She was very big on journaling, and trying to put this manuscript together and structuring it in a way, the structure part of it, the design of this narrative was very important to me, and I wanted to be able to take the reader right into the experience with both of us.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was a lot of work and probably a lot of processing and grieving at the time. I remember crying hysterically one day when I was toward the end of the manuscript and going into her dying, active dying process, and just sobbing and sobbing and sobbing over my keyboard.
Mm.
And but it was very, very good for me to write this out. And I wrote, it was a much longer manuscript, and I ended up cutting 22,000 words because I wanted to get just right to the storyline. And this is really my mother's, she's the heroine. Mm-hmm. She's the protagonist in this. And yes, I'm right there along beside her. But I wanted to do this also as a tribute. I have since learned that it's helped a lot of people wherever they are, whether they have read this after a death, especially of a parent, or headed into that, or wherever. I just had this broad response. Mm-hmm. And so I was effective in that, and that's what was important for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's really not about me. This is a topic that's heavily charged and being written about by physicians and all kinds of people now. And I'm glad it's helping to shift the paradigm, and mm-hmm. especially shifting people out of fear.
Well,
there's really nothing to fear.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, being able to get there and being able to do it together. I mean, this combination of you and your mom, the idea that you had both voices in your writing, that you were mining both journals, is very precious and may be why the book is such easy reading, you know, which is very nice because, as you said, it's our stories that affect us the most. We can do a lot of teaching and, you know, a lot of reading, but when someone tells a story from their heart, it's probably one of our greatest teachers to prevent people from feeling fearful or help them move out of feeling fearful.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
So we said you kind of went in and out of difficult and joyful times with your mom. What was the hardest part overall?
Well, I have to go back to the moment when I walked in to say goodbye to her. I had a short trip planned out of town, not too far away. And when I walked into her room, and I was already apprehensive, I kept thinking, what if she dies while I'm away? And, you know, all these thoughts. And so when I walked in, she had someone there that was doing body work. And she opened her eyes and looked at me and then closed her eyes. And then she started to pull her hand out from under the cover to take my hand. And right as I reached to take her hand, and I was barely holding on emotionally, she pulled her hand back in under the cover and then flicked. It came out again, and she flicked her wrist like goodbye.
Mm.
And I realized when I left, and I was just sobbing all the way to her driveway, that she had, you know, I didn't realize it in that moment, but I realized in the writing of this during the writing of the manuscript that she had, in fact, let me go.
Wow.
And so that didn't come to me until I was writing about it. But I do remember sitting back and saying to myself, wow, she had to do that in order to die.
Mm.
She had to let go of me. And I had so much admiration and respect. I just wish it had been, you know, we talked about everything, but that never came up. And, you know, I don't even know how that would have been for her to say, well, Kate, now I'm going to let go of you because I need to do this in order to die. I think given our relationship and our closeness and how we dialogue, I think that would have helped me. But that was such a shock. I mean, it wasn't a shock at all to find my mother's body
mm-hmm.
At all. It was having her flick her wrist and send me on my way.
Wow.
That was the most difficult. I think that was the most difficult moment of my entire life, actually.
I can imagine.
Yeah. She was cutting the umbilical cord and the heartstrings almost, boom, mm-hmm. right there. So.
Yeah. Well, just the reality of it, not only the most difficult moment, but probably, you know, one of the most powerful. I don't think you can ever get ready for that. Do you think if you'd had more conversations about it, you would have been prepared differently for it?
I think so, and I can't say this about anybody else. It's because of our relationship. It was so, you know, we talked about everything. There was nothing that we left out except that. I think it would have helped me,
mm-hmm.
and I would have maybe gained a greater understanding on, yeah, this. If she's planning a good death and she's dying a conscious death, and yes, this is part of it, because she would say to me, well, all right, why don't you, you know, go home and get some rest or walk Bailey, my dog, and I'm going to call a few people and say goodbye.
Mm-hmm.
So that was her way. But there was never really a, Kate, I need to say goodbye. I need to let you go.
Mm-hmm.
That never really happened. And so I think I would have been, I'd like to say I would have been better prepared for that. But it's a good thing that this came up because in my work, I just recently helped a daughter through this same thing. And her mother was choosing to die a conscious death and fully awake, and I said, there may be a time when your mother will let go of you and she will need to do this.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this woman she was intrigued by that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think at least open, and because you don't know how what's going to happen.
Yeah. I really want to spend a couple minutes talking about conscious death with you because that's definitely what this sounds like to me. But could we go back a little bit? You had been working in death and dying for 29 years, so what were you prepared for? How did that ground you to be able to be present or aware during your mother's death? What did you do for 29 years?
I worked with hospice. I worked privately. I went into final passages for my training as a certified death midwife in 2007 after my dad died a horrible death in ICU. And I just thought there's got to be a different way. And then when my husband died, I do have to say this, he, in 99, he was a physician, and everyone was so detached.
Mm.
I just remember that, even his colleagues, he was detached. It was just like, God, there has to be a different way that we do this.
Mm-hmm.
And we're all going to die. And so I'd say over all these years and reading and self-studying everything I could get my hands on,
mm-hmm.
and my personal experiences with people added to being able to step up with my mother. But my mother, I have to say this, rocked my boat on even all of that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because she was so present and so aware through even her dying process, the last 11 days of her life. It wasn't easy.
Mm-hmm.
And she kept saying, nobody should remember this, Kate. Nobody should have to do this alone.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree.
So part of dying consciously was also working with the actual dying concretely in ritual. And I'm enthralled with the whole idea of D's chair or V's chariot. Could you talk about that? We have about 4 minutes left, and this feels like
sure.
the most important part to me.
Yes. So part of the planning for her death was to pick up the cardboard cremation container early, and there's a scene in the book with that, and it's out in the garage for a little bit, and then she was ready, and she went in and started to collage it. She was an artist, and she wanted it to be a beautiful work of art, and it was. And so when I walked in, and we had moved it into the dining room table for her to work in there, and when I walked in, I saw a little sign attached to the foot of it that said V's Chariot, and I knew it was finished.
Mm.
And then just during a reading, I realized when somebody made a comment about the song by, I think it was Joan Baez, Sweet Chariot Carry Me Home, and I wonder, I think that's where my mother got the idea to call it The Chariot, Beast Chariot, and she loved that song. I mean, Joan Baez, so we never talked about that, but it was a beautiful piece of work, and so it was all, you know, it was a ritual at the end, and I was able to bathe and anoint her body and then lower her into the chariot.
Oh, Mom.
And it was beautiful, everything about it. And then I drove her body. I drove the chariot an hour and a half to the crematory. Very beautiful and empowering and incredible.
Mm-hmm. And incredibly symbolic. Like I said, felt like you midwifed her out beautifully.
Yeah, yeah.
We should all have that kind of relationship. Wouldn't that be amazing?
Oh,
be amazing.
It would be. And we can do this, but, you know, it's, again, it's a choice. And so I say take baby steps. I didn't reach this place overnight.
Mm-hmm.
It's been over time, but, yeah.
Well, that's what we're doing here, is continuing to learn, and learning from our parents and our ancestors is really an important part of bringing it forward. We're not doing it ourselves. So,
right.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you for what you did with her. And before we get done, I want you to just tell people how to get a hold of you, a little bit about your website, so they can follow up.
Sure. So my website is Kate Riley, KateRiley.org. And I have an About Me page is pretty extensive, and also an extensive resource page for people, books and audios. I'm going to be adding some more to that next week. And
and can they order your book on the website?
Yes.
Okay, perfect.
Yep. Yeah.
Great.
So I'm happy to inscribe them and mail them, you know, wherever.
Mm. Perfect. Well, this is Kim Mooney with Practically Dying. My website is practically-dying.com. I'm working again with KGNU. I do a quarterly show on death and dying issues here. And it's been a wonderful radio station to work with. As I said before, and I say regularly, this is a huge community resource and asset. And so interviews like this allow us to talk to people who don't live here and get some ideas from people who've done amazing work around the country on death and dying, reducing the fear, and just telling precious stories like this. So once again, Kate Riley, thank you so much for talking to us about your mother and your book.
Thank you, Kim. It's been a pleasure.
Take good care.